Welcome to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm Drew's co-host, entertainment writer Jim Hill, and he and I are recording the show on Friday, August 2nd, 2019. And look, folks, I apologize. We missed a week here, and that's entirely my fault, not Drew's. It's been 7 weeks since Nancy had her back surgery, and we're just about to begin the physical therapy portion of her recovery, but in order to set that up, we had to make this seemingly endless round of trips to the hospital, as each of the doctors that had a hand in her procedure had to first run tests and then sign off on the idea that Nancy was well enough and her recovery to begin physical therapy. And long story short, Drew, I hate modern medicine. You know, I never want to go back to a hospital. And so, long story short, folks, don't ever get sick. Don't ever get old, because you don't want to go to a hospital. Anyway, it's not like Drew hasn't been busy while we haven't been recording. I mean, you did a coffee with Kenobi with Dan Zayer, right?
Oh, I did. Yeah. So if you need a fix of me, you can go over there. We were just talking about Comic-Con and D23 and all sorts of stuff.
Cool. Now, speaking of which, you were also down in San Diego for Comic-Con this year, though. As you were arriving, they were doing the DuckTales panel, right?
Or? Yeah, people were sending me, like, text messages of, like, images that were being revealed at the DuckTales panel as I was coming in. And for good reason. I mean, did you see some of the artwork that they released?
Well, for years I have seen cute little Wuzzles. And what did you think of the new the show's new take on the Wuzzles, which, again, I think a nightmare fuel for children throughout the world. So
I thought they were pretty cool. I also thought it was pretty interesting. Did you see that Goofy is going to be a part of the show?
Goofy's going to be part of the show. Tailspin's going to be part of the show.
Tailspin, Chip and Dale.
Yeah, I mean, look, don't get me wrong. As a fan of the Disney Afternoon back in the day, I loved this idea, but how much meta is meta here? Do you think this is too much fan servicing, or?
I don't know. It looks like, to me, they're kind of doing like a Disney Afternoon shared universe kind of situation.
Okay.
And I wonder if anything will be spun off from DuckTales.
Okay.
I mean, the art style is there. The storytelling is there. I mean, you and I love DuckTales. And as you've seen on Twitter and, like, people just coming up to us, they blame us for them watching DuckTales now, which I'm very happy about. I feel like we are like, evangelizing DuckTales every week, so.
And I can't, don't get me wrong, I love what they've done so far. I just, when they released that poster, which literally showed this tidal wave of characters falling out of the sky, it was like, woof. I just worry with all of these characters coming in, there's a lot of story to service here already. I mean, we have Della back on Earth, we have Donald back on the moon, and I really want to see what happens next with the whole Darkwing Duck thing. I mean, I love how Jim Cummings has gone from being the voice of Darkwing Duck from the Disney Afternoon version to now, in the mythos that we're carving out for the DuckTales reboot, you know, he's, sorry if this is a spoiler to anyone, but now he's going to be voicing Negaduck.
Yeah.
And
that was a great twist.
That was a killer twist, you know, and just, I can't wait to see where that goes. And look, while we're talking about huge voice talents like Jim Cummings, I guess we have to acknowledge that, you know, in between the last time we recorded shows, Drew, we lost a genuine Disney legend, a Russi Taylor. And
yeah, very sad.
Yeah. What's fascinating to me is how Russi got the gig. Disney was in the middle of, this is what, 86? Michael Eisner has come through the door in 84, thereabouts, and they're looking for ways to make the Disney characters more popular. And this is, you know, MTV is taking off, and, you know, here are all these powerful females, you know, doing stuff for MTV, Madonna, Cyndi Lauper, and the like. And somebody at Disney makes a decision that Minnie should be like that. So they bring in, they decide they're going to do this thing called Totally Minnie, where they're going to revamp her look and, you know, revamp the character. And Russi comes in during that period and auditions for the role. And There's something about what she does that they like, and they think, okay, this will be a fun, new, modern take on Minnie. The interesting thing is, in a very short window of time, Disney made this decision about the characters. In fact, this is it's a credit to Rick Dempsey. Did you ever get to meet Rick when you were at the company, Drew?
No, I never met him.
Okay, well, Rick was the gentleman who was in charge of, let me see if I get the name right here, the Disney Character Voice Department.
Which is still a department in the company.
Yeah, well because of, but this was the thing. The thinking was at that point that, you know, for example, if Consumer Products was going to put a talking Mickey doll out, they had an actor that he went to. If the parks were doing a parade, there was another voice actor they went to get Mickey's voice. If the ice shows, needed a Mickey, there was another. And it's just the notion was there was a lack of consistency with the character. And Rick sort of rammed through the idea of, look, in order for the character to be strong and consistent, we need one person voicing the character. And so inside of a single four-year period, they locked in 83, Wayne L. Wayne is the voice of Mickey. In 1985, Tony Ensemble became the voice of Donald. 1986, they brought in Roosie to do Minnie. And finally, in 1987, here comes Bill Farmer. And he ends up as the voice of Goofy. And the interesting thing is, while totally Minnie flamed out relatively shortly, people just loved working with Roosie. They loved her good humor, her professionalism, the unique spin she put on lines for Minnie and that sort of thing. And she stuck. And more to the point, as she was standing there in the recording booth, recording stuff for the parks or consumer products, and typically she was, because again, it's Mickey and Minnie. And she worked side by side with Wayne, and by 1991, they were not only a couple, they got married, and which then started an interesting chapter in their lives, because Disney, did you hear about this, Drew, that Disney wouldn't allow them to reveal that they'd been married for 5 years?
No, I had no idea.
They just figured it's like, in fact, have you seen the item in the past week or so? I want to say the woman who plays the co-captain of the Orville and one of the supporting cast members, that they got married and 2 months later they're getting divorced. And
oh,
so it's going to be an interesting set, come season three. But that was the fear of Disney, that is, oh God, this is going to be a Hollywood marriage, and that in a couple of years they're going to split and that'll be the headlines, Mickey and Minnie divorce. But no, they were the real thing. They and by 96, the company was comfortable enough, like, okay, you're a thing. We can talk about this now. I got lucky enough to interview Wayne and Roosie, and they talked about one of the more interesting aspects of their job was they'd have somebody from like Consumer Products come through with copy for a commercial or that sort of thing. And, it's like Mickey hawking auto parts or something like that. And, they had to figure out a way gently, because of course these are the people who are signing their check, to the effect of, I don't think Mickey would say that. And then work with them to try to find a way to, how would Mickey say this? Because Mickey isn't necessarily a salesman, or likewise Minnie. And anyway, we jump ahead to 2009. Wayne passes due to complications from diabetes, and Roosie actually, obviously was devastated at the loss of her husband and gave some thought to sort of hanging up her spurs, deciding that, maybe I don't want to continue on as Minnie. But eventually she returned behind the mic, and Wayne was such a huge talent that they actually needed two people to replace him. They brought in Brett Iwin. He's the one who does the more straightforward Mickey, the Mickey that you hear in, say, Roadster Racers or the, the Ice Capades or that sort of thing. Whereas it's Chris Diamopoulos. Am I saying that name right? Or
I have no idea.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Chris is
from Silicon Valley. Yeah. I cannot believe that it's the same person from Silicon Valley.
Well, that do, or for that matter, from the Three Stooges reboot, the Mo.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and but Chris honestly is my favorite Mickey right now. I mean, he just,
I agree.
You know, the work that he does on the Paul Rudder shorts, you know, and they've only been producing those since 2013. And in fact, that honestly, I'm happy that Russi hung in there long enough that the Paul Rudder shorts became a reality, because I, from what I heard from Bill Farmer, they just loved working on the shorts that Paul put together, because they walked into it, they never, you know, after years of predictable patter for the parks and parades and consumer products, the crazy stuff that they got to say for the shorts and the weird situations they got dropped in, you know, it was constantly a creative challenge, and, you know, something they really, really enjoyed doing. And look, Russi clearly had fans at Television Animation. They loved her work. And in fact, I can't help but think, given the timing of things, just before we started recording today, Drew, you got to see the latest Mickey Mouse short, Carried Away.
Yeah, which was lovely.
Yeah, and it just, what's kind of interesting about this short is it's literally Russi singing through 90% of the short. She's singing this brand new song called Carried Away, and I can't help, given that this became available for downloading on Friday, the day before Russi passed, I'm just wondering if maybe somebody in Paul Reddish's team knew about health issues, because I hadn't heard a word.
No, yeah, she ended up dying of complications from cancer, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah, so, in Glendale, mm-hmm. which is, you know, right around where I live currently.
Okay. So yeah. Maybe, you know, that maybe they got the heads up and selected the short to put out. Because it's interesting, you can now also find online a version of the song that Russi sang with it, where they remove all of Mickey's screams and the sounds of the piranha feeding frenzy. But but yeah, if you haven't seen the short, folks, yet, check it out. Or likewise, chase down Russi singing. It's well worth it. And take some comfort in that we haven't heard her last performance yet. You know, May of next year? They're going to be opening Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway? Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, did you see online there were, like, pictures of her in the recording booth for that?
Yeah.
I think that must have been her last big project for the studio.
Okay.
I'm guessing? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, we're not just losing Minnie here, folks. We you know, it's also Baby Gonzo from the hand-drawn Muppet Babies, Simpsons. We lose Martin Price, Sherry and Terry, and Uter. I love that Al Jean, the longtime producer of The Simpsons, made a point of tweeting out a tribute to Russi. And you were mentioning before we get started here, also, she's in a lot of the Studio Ghibli stuff that Disney sort of redubbed, right?
Or... Yeah, she was in a lot of the localized versions of Studio Ghibli movies, which is really another sort of amazing contribution to the legacy of animation and her voice legacy, obviously. But, you know, I love anything 80s mm-hmm. Disney, and so I love that she was brought in for the Totally Minnie project, which is very much worth checking out. There are some really bizarre videos sort of introducing this concept to people, as you know.
Yeah.
Still on YouTube, but I love that she came in on that kind of bizarre mm-hmm. project and then ended up staying and becoming this kind of, like, I mean, a whole generation's voice of Minnie too. I mean, even when they did, I was going to talk about this, was the Get a Horse,
mm-hmm.
and they had Walt, you know, they had all the Walt dialogue for Mickey, but Minnie was still Russi, which I thought was really
interesting, and
great.
That's
so right. She recorded new dialogue, yeah.
Holy cow. Oh my God, I forgot about that. Yeah. Oh, geez. Now, yeah. Again, just a huge, huge loss, folks. Okay, so we moving on from a tragedy to, well, a tragedy. So, Drew, let's talk about this Cats trailer. When did you get to see this?
I saw it the night that it premiered. I as my social media duties for Movie Phone command, I am on top of every trailer and every trailer launch. And so I had seen the behind the scenes footage, which you had also seen, I'm sure, the day before, where they said, oh, this is going to be super realistic fur technology. But then you watch the trailer And you notice, and I'm sure, you know, people who aren't animation fans notice that these characters are completely performance capture. I mean, there's no layer of animation, and it just looks bizarre. Like, I don't know. I just don't know what the point of it was. I don't know what the point of doing performance capture is if you're just going to make them look like humans in, you know, big coats like they are on stage. I mean, I'm still curious. Tom Hooper is not a favorite director of mine, but I'm curious. I'm very curious.
Okay. No, I you know, and I guess to mount a very mild defense here, it's like, look, if you're hiring Taylor Swift or Jennifer Hudson or a Dame Judi Dench, and, you know, to be in, you know, your big screen musical, you want people to see your movie stars. Also, when you think about the stage version of Cats, which, just to give you some perspective here, folks, the London version opened in May of 1981 and ran for 19 years. The Broadway version opened in 82 and ran for 18 years. So, you know, a lot of people went to go see this show of people on stage dressed as cats with, you know, elaborate makeups and that sort of thing. So the thinking was, well, there's already an audience out there that's seen this show sort of like this.
Right.
So I get the idea. The execution, and again, I guess, you know, once again, it's one of these things where it's like, okay, it's just the trailer, you know, it's only 2 minutes, you know, maybe we need to see this in context.
Well, but you and I also remember when Steven Spielberg was trying to do an actual animated
and now you're going to break my heart. Yes, yes. Amblin-mation, this was mid-90s, early 90s, right?
The article I see is the early 90s, and it was to be directed by Simon Wells and Phil Nibelink. And then I guess when Amblimation shut down in 97, the project was just abandoned. But if you look at the trailer or look at this new catch, you'll see that it is produced by Amblin, which leads me to believe that they retained the rights this whole time. But you can find concept art, and it is pretty amazing what they were going to do.
It's gorgeous. It just, you know, and in fact, if you drill down into it, Spielberg, for example, insisted that the story was going to be set just after the Blitz in London. So there were, you know, in the heart of London, you had all of this destruction. And you know, but at the same time, you had these pristine buildings standing out, you know, in the middle of the war zones. And it gave it a distinct time period, a distinct feel. Again, it kind of breaks your heart that they got this close. I mean, there's, you know, if you drill down, there's character model sheets for, like, McCaverty and, you know, and that sort of thing. They had a way into the material.
Yeah, and if you want, Hans Bakker put up a bunch of his sort of production design notes, which again is, you know, mirroring the post Blitz setting, and it's amazing. I mean, if you don't know Hans Bakker, he did character design for Hercules and Lion King and all these other Mulan, and, you know, so it's amazing.
You gotta wonder, because remember, on the other side of this, you know, Universal is getting serious finally about the movie version of Wicked, and you gotta wonder, on the heels of the response to doing something like Cats, which is trying to sort of work that Venn diagram of a movie that is still somehow faithful to what the Broadway musical looked like, you gotta wonder what's going to happen with Wicked on the other side of this if this doesn't connect.
Well, is there still talk of turning the Marvel Land into Wicked and Islands of Adventure?
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is, again, with, if you think about the Endgame pile of money that they have to now move to make room for the Aladdin pile of money and the Lion King pile of money, each time Disney does something like this, merges with a 20th Century Fox or that sort of thing, you end up with, you know, instead of an 800-pound gorilla, an 8,000-pound gorilla. And evidently there continue to be back-channel discussions about, what is it exactly we need to do to finally get you guys to surrender the rights to, you know, the theme park rights to Marvel in the States? And then, of course, you know, Universal would have to reinvent that area. And again, given that they actually built a Wicked Land in a temporary show that was kind of a cut-down version of Wicked for Universal Studios Japan, there's a precedent. But yeah, it's one of these things where it's like they haven't reached those terms yet. Disney doesn't have the bright enough bauble yet to dangle in front of Comcast, but that doesn't mean it isn't going to happen anytime soon. And speaking, though, of 20th Century Fox, just today, as Drew and I were getting to record, a Variety broke news that the layoffs continue as they consolidate, as they merge the two companies, and several dozen folks who work in visual effects were let go. And in fact, since we've been away, Drew, Andrea Millaro, the co-president of Fox Animation, stepped down. Did you see that? Or?
Yeah, I did. And it was weird, though, because they were describing her as not only the co-president of Fox Animation, but like the head of Blue Sky.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was interesting because, you know, I used to live in Fairfield, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
Blue Sky's in Greenwich. I would go there a lot. Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. Her letter was really interesting. Do you want to read that?
Yeah, okay. So this is her goodbye memo, and it reads as follows. I am writing today with some news that is difficult to share, but I wanted you to hear it from me. I will be leaving Blue Sky. 2 years ago, we began a journey to elevate and evolve this vibrant studio. We embarked on a robust development slate, attracting new talent and pushing forward with technology to support the storytelling. Blue Sky has always been a force for powerful family entertainment, and for the past 10 years, I have loved being part of the family. While this is the end of my Blue Sky journey, I know that the studio will continue to surpass the very high expectations we set out for ourselves. Thanks for so many wonderful memories, and I wish everyone the very best. And it's important to note here that her co-president, Robert Baird, is remaining at the studio. This is weird timing, Drew. I mean, just there's no other way to describe this. Because face it, you know, Spies in Disguise, which you and I have talked about in the past because it's pushed its release date, and they just brought in Mark Ronson to overhaul the music, and it's just been announced, in fact, back on July 23rd, that Reba McEntire and Rachel Brosnahan will be coming in to add to the voice cast of Spies in Disguise. And I think you were talking about, you know, as we were pre-gaming, that this movie was supposed to have been out months ago. And so the fact that
they're adding people to the cast is like, oh my God,
yeah.
What shape is this thing in?
Well, you know, but again, you know, it just look, you know, I think to put a positive spin on this, the fact that Disney is still plussing the project as it tries to evaluate where exactly Blue Sky fits in with the whole, you know, the Disney Plus world, you know, with this whole streaming service launching on, you know, November 12th. And look, it certainly doesn't hurt Spies in Disguise that it's coming on the heels of the Guy Ritchie live-action imagining of Aladdin, as I think we just mentioned, that, you know, just made $1 billion. So, you know, and that starred Will Smith, and Will Smith is the voice of Lance Sterling in Spies in Disguise. So, you know, that gives you, you know, something to promote the star of this billion-dollar film. You know, it is voicing an animated character in our, you know, our Christmas Day release. So, but on the other hand, Aladdin took months to reach that billion-dollar thing, whereas Jon Favreau's Lion King did it in under 2 weeks. Is that correct, Drew? Or?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I don't think anyone at the studio thought that it was going to make that much money.
No,
I think they were probably hoping to clear 500, so the fact that it cleared a billion is pretty astounding.
Well, but a lot of that, again, is overseas. That this thing went from having legs to, like, sequoias. You know, just it was kind of startling. Speaking of Will Smith, though, was it this week that you got to see the 20 minutes from Gemini Man? Or
last week.
Last week.
Okay. I did, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And, you know, I know we've talked about this project earlier on Fine Tuning Folks, but this is the film that genuinely blurs the line when it comes to live action and, you know, what you can do photorealistically with character doubling here. And tell you what, when we get back from the break, Drew's going to share everything he learned about this upcoming On Me film.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay, and we're back. But before we get started talking about Gemini Man, which, again, cutting edge, at least effects-wise, a thriller about a government assassin and his clone, I wanted to give a quick nod to Archer, which just this past week wrapped up its 10th season. And I got to tell you, Drew, did you catch any of the run for season 10, the whole...
No, I mean, I've been very fascinated with the fact that the show has been switching formats every season, seemingly, for the past few years.
Yeah, 3 years
now. But I've not
now.
Kept up with it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Adam Reed and company, the show's creator, did a bang-up job to sort of, you know, slide back in to where we left off after, again, 3 seasons of swapping up swapping at the firmware. We had, the season where... You know, Archer was a film noir detective in 40s Hollywood. We had him playing a pilot and sort of an adventure serial from the 30s. And finally, again, the co-captain of a ship in deep space. Well, again, 1999, you know, with Archer 1999, to give you some idea of the time frame and the show design. And at the tail end of this episode, Archer came out of his coma. And the thing is, they're going real time. He's been in a coma for 3 years. And the world has changed. You know, a lot of the other characters in the show have moved on. And that, for me, is what's going to make season 11, which gets started... late next spring, going to be fascinating. But again, 3 years is nothing compared to the 22 years that Gemini Man has been in development. I mean, look, folks, Drew and I have talked previously about this project that did, started in 97 at Disney Secret Lab. It was a project that they tried to build around Mel Gibson and Harrison Ford, Sean Connery, even, I guess, Clint Eastwood, which... that I find really, really fascinating. But Disney kept making runs at this for 20 plus years until finally they gave up and sold the film rights in 2016 to Skydance Media. Mm-hmm. And then in October of 2017, Skydance brings Ang Lee in to direct, which I get, you know, from, what was it, Life of Pi?
Yeah,
you know, this is a guy who, you know, is comfortable in an effects heavy movie, but can also get an amazing performance out of actors. But so anyway, it shot last year between February through May, and it's basically been in post ever since, right?
Yeah, he was there along with Bruckheimer and Will Smith, and he said he just finally approved the first shot that went into the post-production pipeline, like that week
Holy
or something.
Holy cow, really?
Yeah, and it comes out in October, so hopefully those shots will be coming in a little bit quicker. But yeah, I wanted to tell everybody, if they want to see some development stuff from the original version, Google or type into YouTube Human Face Project. Mm-hmm. Which I'm sure you've seen this video. The kind of attempt at... It's actually... It's not bad.
If you put it in context, if you put it... You know, if you understand at that time, this was the best they could do. And remember, you know, this is Secret Lab. These are people who were working on what at that point is the cutting edge. But, you know, we're still... You know, well, look, how many times did you hear Uncanny Valley when you were... You know, at this presentation last week.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing that they stressed more than anything else is that this is not digital de-aging.
Mm-hmm.
This is not what Marvel does. This is a completely CGI character. And it was created by Weta. They referred to the younger version of Will Smith. Did you talk about what the movie's about? Because it's about, like, a younger Will Smith's clone coming to kill him. They're both hitmen.
Mm-hmm.
And they said what was interesting was they, of course, cast the one actor who hasn't aged in 25 years. So he actually, as his like main performance,
yeah.
He had to go look older. They put more gray. They let his gray show up in his temples and in his beard. They kind of like put some crow's feet in there to try to make him actually look older. And the other thing about this movie that is very jarring mm-hmm. is that it is shot in 120 frames per second 3D. Now, I don't know if any of our listeners saw The Hobbit when it was released. I think the first one was in 48 frames and the second two were in 60 frames.
Mm-hmm.
So this is twice as high a frame rate as the highest Hobbit movie. So it doesn't really look like a movie. I mean, it looks like you opened a window and looked outside. There's no motion blurring, which is such a tenet of animation. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I think you and I have talked about the like hand painted motion blurring mm-hmm. in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, where they would literally just paint smudges mm-hmm. in every time that they would move, which is so great. But there's none of that. So I went to a VFX presentation after the footage, and they said that they're basically, it's like 30% more pixels or something. They have to render because you're seeing so much more of the character.
Wow.
Which is insane. So they showed three scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And the third scene was this really emotional scene with the character. And it was very affecting. I mean, it was a very emotional Ang Lee scene, but with a computer-generated Will Smith.
Mm-hmm.
The second scene was this fight in the catacombs. And during the VFX presentation, what was really interesting was they said, you know, at a certain point, we just replaced both of the Will Smiths.
Ooh.
So it was literally two computer-generated Will Smiths fighting underground in a catacomb. And, I mean, the entire approach to the movie is different because of the 120 frames per second. The lighting is different. The exposure is different. The framing is different. I mean, it is really some next-level stuff. I mean, Jerry Bruckheimer compared it from film going to black and white to color, which I'm not sure I totally agree with,
mm-hmm.
but I'm very interested to see how it's going to look finished,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't look like a movie we've ever seen. And it was really interesting going from that in the morning, and then later in the afternoon I had a screening of the new Tarantino movie, which is shot in 35. It was projected in 35. It was this beautiful kind of velvety, you know, experience. And Gemini Man was just really crisp and kind of jarring. And I'm very eager to see it,
mm-hmm.
but I just don't know how well it's going to come off. But the effects are beautiful. I don't know. I just don't know. Hmm. I don't know. But I'm very curious just to see more footage and to see the final version, see what people think about it. Like, one, how many theaters are going to be equipped with this?
Well, that's my first question. I mean, remember when The Hobbit came out and, you know, the pushback that got. I mean, obviously, we're in a much different place. You know, if you think about how many theaters now in the country are, you know, digital projection and that sort of thing. And
yeah, but I think that they have to have some kind of special apparatus. Because remember, I'm sure you remember when The Hobbit came out and you would go into New York and see, like, subway ads mm-hmm. where it would say, like, rapid frame rate projection or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, okay, but where can I see this? And then the other thing is, like, with the amount of people that watch things at home, either on Blu-ray or streaming, how is this going to work, you know, on home video? Like, is it just going to look completely different? It's very interesting to, I really appreciate Ang Lee trying to get people into the theater. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great idea and a great instinct, but it seems short-sighted to create a movie that you can only see in such a narrow and specific way. You know what I mean? Like, in New Hampshire, is there 120 frames a second, you know, projector and a three, you know, I don't know.
That's it exactly. And but at the same time, I face it, somebody's got to make the path. You know, it's like, who was the first person who bought the first portable phone? You know, back in the day when it was the size of a shoebox. You know, I mean, if this is where movie making is eventually going to go, you know, this frame rate somebody's got to be the first out of the gate. And
well, and we know that the Avatar sequels are being shot in 120 frames.
That's an excellent point. That's an excellent point. So
if there's somebody that can motivate people to change the format, it's Disney.
Yeah.
As we've known, I mean, Walt Disney basically created the color television craze, as we've talked about before. So, I mean, if there's anybody that can do it, it's them. So, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see where this goes. But I'm very curious to hear your thoughts, Jim, when you finally get to see more of this.
Cannot wait to see it. And speaking of things I'm genuinely looking forward to seeing, you know, this show, when it drops on Tuesday the 6th, you folks are going to have to play catch-up at this point because Cartoon Network's next big programming event, Infinity Train, will actually have debuted on Monday, August 5th. But this is by Owen Dennis, writer and storyboard artist at who did the regular show. And what's kind of interesting is from friends in the industry, if you've been hearing this is what I've been hearing, that a lot of people are making the comparison to Over the Garden Wall.
Yes. And from what I understand, this was done pretty quickly after Over the Garden Wall. I don't know why it's taken so long to air, but I think you and I are both very excited that it's actually going to air.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that because, again, you know, that if you drill down that this supposedly, you know, initially they were talking about this airing in 2016 and here we're in 2019. It finally bubbles up. And at the same time, this runs through the 9th and on August 9th, in fact, you and I have talked about this, Drew, the Rocko's Modern World Static Cling finally becomes available for streaming on Netflix. And same thing. This one has been in the can for quite some time. So, you know, I just I would love it if somebody wants to come forward and share about, you know, what happened with both Infinity Train and Static Cling. Why?
Well, I mean, I think your theory on it, Static Cling, is probably correct, which is that they got a look at a hour-long Rocko special and said, who is this for, exactly?
Well,
in the year of our Lord, 2019.
Well, speaking of, and don't get me wrong, look, you and I both love Gennady Tartakovsky, you know.
Oh,
and, you
genius.
Know, no, absolutely. But the trailer that's out for Primal right now, where the dinosaurs fight and one literally takes the snout off of one of the others and there's blood and things fall over and that's it. I mean, it's amazing animation, and I understand this is running during Adult Swim, so in theory, impressionable children are not going to be affected by this. But as an impressionable adult, I was like, whoa! You know,
Jim, this is what happens when you're forced to make 3 Hotel Transylvania movies in a row. You got some stuff pent up. You know what I mean? You gotta let it out. You know. So.
So this is what you're saying is this is therapy for Gennady.
Yes. Yes.
Just sort of like, wow.
This is just raw. It is primal. I mean, I thought that footage looked amazing.
No.
I love that shot of the caveman swinging his arm around.
Oh God, yeah.
I mean, it's just pure animation. He swings his arm around towards camera and then knocks into a dinosaur's leg. And it is one of the most beautiful pieces of character animation I've seen in a long time.
I totally agree. I'm not knocking the craft, but I wow. I love your take on this, because now when I see that footage with the snout being ripped off, I'm just going to picture this is Gennady dealing with every Sony, you know, animation executive who was like, yeah, about that scene.
That's him responding to, oh, Popeye is canceled? Okay, all right, I'm going to take it out. Yeah.
Oh, I love your take. speaking of loving your take, I've so been enjoying about, you know, what you guys have been doing with Light the Fuse. And so we're headed summer into fall. What have we got prepping?
Yeah, I mean, we're hopefully going to have some more. I mean, I talked to Hans Zimmer about coming on the show, so hopefully he'll come on. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of really big people that are, like, on the cusp of coming on the show, but have yet to, like, formally sign on, so I don't want to give away the store quite yet. But we've got some great interviews this week. We're talking to a guy named Mikey Newman, who's a great video essayist on YouTube and just did a really cool video about Mission Impossible. So we talked to him about that stuff. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we've recorded a bunch. We talked to Carly Wiesel, a friend of the podcast.
Oh, and
who came on Touring Plans.
Okay, yeah.
We talk about the proposed Paramount parks in London and Korea.
Oh,
and
God,
we talk about
yes.
what we want out of a a Mission Impossible themed area. So that's really fun. And then on our Patreon, she tells us a story about going to the Conan O'Brien show taping at San Diego, where Tom Cruise was there. And so that's really fun. So yeah, listen to Light the Fuse wherever you listen to podcasts and rate and review. And if you are feeling very generous, go to patreon.com/lightthefuse. So yeah. Anything helps?
No, it's all good stuff. Oh, can't wait to hear the Carly stuff. I love her. Okay. On my side of the fence, it's the usual pile of crud here, folks. We've got the Disney Dish that I do with Len Testo, where we look at the Disney parks. We have Looking at Lucasfilm with Dan Zare, and we talk about all of the Star Wars-related stuff that's going on out there. Marvel Us Disney, which I do in Aaron Adams, obviously looks at the Marvel Studios side of the fence, Universal Joint, which I do with Dustin Fuse, and there's no Universal news we're talking about.
Oh, there's some epic news, Jim.
We'll get to that on our next show, and then we have, in fact, just this weekend, we're recording a brand new episode of I Want That with Cheryl Valladolid. It was just
speaking of therapy.
Yeah, well, by the way. If ever I've seen a toy that needs therapy, we were in the Disney store outlet in Merrimack, New Hampshire just yesterday, and saw the toys the talking Nala toy that's been created for the Jon Favreau Lion King, and oh my God, Drew, this thing is the stuff of nightmares. You know, it literally talks, but it has a mouthful of serrated teeth. So, you know, perfect thing to put in a child's crib. It's like, Mommy and Daddy love you. You know, and please try not to get eaten by the mechanical lion.
Oh, yeah. They gave us one at the junket. It's still in the box. I mean, the only thing that I can think to do with it is scare the dog. And I don't think think that's an altruistic endeavor to use that toy.
I was about to say, you know, that Nova, that if you want to put Nova back into therapy, that's the toy to break out. So, well, anyway, we'll talk more about horrifying toys on our next episode, folks. But for now, on behalf of Mr. Taylor, thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.